The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slip or Trip, The $1 Million Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida. Louis, was there ever a case that you really didn't want to win?
Yes, I just was telling you about one where I had great concern about winning the case morally. But a client, whether it's an individual or a corporation, is entitled to representation. Now, sometimes you don't want to take a case because of the moral problem, but I think that's unethical. I think that a lawyer should take all the cases that come to them and do their best job because they're sworn to do it and use the best ability they have under the law to protect the client. You don't have to believe what the client believes. However, there's also an economic factor, because if you're a good lawyer and you're expensive and the other side can't afford a good lawyer and they're not as competent as you, then your expertise and ability to do research and to run surveillance and so on makes it a tilted battlefield. So you have all the equipment, you have the artillery, and they have pop guns. So it's very interesting. I'll tell you this story. This is the case I wanted to lose that I tried for the Miami Daily News. The Miami Daily News was calling me for a conference. One of their newsboys was seriously injured while hawking papers on the street. He had head injuries and a severely fractured hip. He might be paralyzed from the waist down. The issue was going to be whether or not he was an employee or an independent contractor. I was told, "We have to defend this case vigorously. It's a matter of principle. Our very existence depends on our newsboys being independent contractors." That was the general manager. A 12-year-old child was an independent contractor? What? It was the first and only case I can remember wanting to lose. Charlie Sims was 11 years old when he learned from some of his friends that you could make money by delivering or selling newspapers. He was a skinny little Afro-American kid with a big grin. He had holes in the bottom of his tennis sneakers. His father had left the family when Charlie was 3, and the mom worked hard as a maid. They lived with his grandparents in a wooden house in downtown Miami. Grandpa was a mailman, but he got paid as a part-time worker. Grandma took an ironing. Between the 3 wage earners, they barely got by. The other kids took Charlie to the corner where the Miami Daily News distributor would bring his truck to unload. Mr. Mick, the distributor, gave Charlie a paper to have his mother sign, and it said that she understood and agreed, as Charlie's parent, that he would be an independent contractor for Mr. Mick and not an employee. Charlie could pick up the newspapers at a place designated by the Miami News distributor, and he could sell them on a particular street corner selected by the Miami News distributor at a set time each day. And he would turn over the money he received to the Miami News distributor, and he would return the unsold papers to the distributor, and he would be paid by the distributor based on the number of papers he sold. Charlie would at all times follow the rules and regulations as set down by the distributor, and he would keep strict account of the money he received from the sales, and he would not be tardy. If he missed work, he would be docked, and if he missed too much time, he would be terminated. He could get a friend to be a substitute in an emergency, but not on a regular basis. He would have to attend newsboy meetings. He would have to behave in a respectful and refined manner. He would have to wear a collared shirt and have a haircut and be clean. There was no room for discussion or negotiation with the Miami Daily News or its distributor. Mrs. Sims didn't understand the 3-page single-spaced contract, which was loaded with legal jargon. There were a lot of whereas clauses. Nevertheless, she signed at the X mark where it said parent and or guardian. Mr. Mick drove Charlie to his assigned street corner at Northwest 54th Street and Northwest 27th Avenue and showed him how to fold the newspaper and hold the newspaper up in the air and wave it slightly so that the drivers could see it but not read it. Well, Charlie started. It later came out that Mrs. Sims, who had a 5th grade education, was under the impression that Mr. Mick, the distributor, was a representative of the Miami News. In fact, Mr. Mick drove a big silver metallic truck that was titled in his own name, but was fully financed and supplied by the Miami News. Mick merely signed his name on a document and was given the keys to the truck. The Miami Daily News held a large lien on the title. All the distributors had the same type of Ford truck. all had the same make and all had the same model. Some even had the Miami Daily News printed on the side, although they were instructed to keep the truck free of any signs. The distributors were also required to attend meetings and follow rules and regulations and not use the truck for any work or activity other than the delivery of newspapers and could not carry passengers. They each were assigned a very specific exclusive district within the Miami News service area. They were not to distribute or sell any other distributors' areas. Mr. Mick bought his newspapers from the Miami News. They set the price. There was no bargaining. Mick was told what the newspapers were to charge, and Mick returned the unsold papers to the News and was given a credit. Mick's contract with the News also said that he was also an independent contractor, but the rules and regulations made both Mick and Charlie goodwill ambassadors for the Miami News. And so the Miami News had an army of over 50 distributors and hundreds of children from poor, uneducated families working for them out in the streets as salesperson in the newspaper's sales network without any insurance or without any protection. It was a drizzly evening in February with the temperature hovering at around 65 degrees when the rusty, old, uninsured lawn service pickup truck hit Charlie as he was standing in the street, smiling, with his left hand up in the air, showing the Miami News. The ambulance took him, unconscious, to Jackson Memorial Hospital, where he was treated. He was uninsured, and the family was billed for his concussion and his fractured hip, which didn't paralyze him, but would result in a foreshortened leg with a permanent limp. Mrs. Sims was a mess. She had trouble taking time off to visit Charlie, and when the bills started coming in, wow, they came in for thousands and thousands of dollars with threats of lawsuits, collection company calls, and the destruction of what little credit she had. The Miami Daily News steadfastly denied any liability or responsibility for Charlie. They took the position that he was an independent contractor of an independent contractor. I defended them when Ira Druba, a bright Harvard Law School graduate, took on Charlie's case. Druba filed for workers' compensation benefits, claiming that Charlie was an employee of an agent of the Miami News and in effect an employee of the Miami News, taking orders from and being controlled by them through Mr. Mick. Druba contested the independent contractor agreement, which Mrs. Sims signed, as being against public policy, being replete with legal conclusions, not being fully explained to Mrs. Sims so that she could understand it, and allowing minors to be subject to great risks without being adequately represented or protected. He argued that, in fact, the Miami News controlled the details of Charlie's work, which was being performed in furtherance of their business and which was an integral part of the newspaper business, and that the independent contractor defense was a sham. Charlie was really an employee. Druba showed that the Miami Daily News had a sales force. They controlled how the sales were made, where they were made, and the price for the goods sold. Charlie wasn't like a lawn man who could take on as many or as few lawns as he wished, set his own prices, control his own hours, who owned his own equipment and could hire others to do the work. Charlie had to attend meetings. He was told exactly how he was to do his job, and he had specific street corner exclusively turned over to him and sold the prices that the News set. This was a scheme to illegally and unethically exploit child labor. And now Charlie's life was damaged forever and his mother was bankrupt. Well, the Miami News had a strong case too. Newsboys were deemed independent contractors historically. The newspapers could not exist without a distribution network. And if the newsboys would become employees, the child labor laws would prohibit their employment. Even an exception could be obtained. The child labor laws would cause them to pay high salaries with fringe benefits like Social Security and workers' compensation and would become prohibitive, and the cost would be unbearable, and the newspapers would lose circulation, they would lose advertising, and they would probably go out of business because the public was not going to pay a large amount for the daily paper. The Miami News argued that the contract was binding, being signed by the parent and natural guardian of the child. The Miami Daily News didn't control Charlie's duties or obligations to attend meetings or instruct him how to sell papers. The Miami Daily News had no control over the distributors. Newspapers were sold to the distributors, who resold them to the newsboys, and the newsboys resold them for a profit. Once Charlie was selling papers, he was acting alone. He could perform in accordance with his own methods and was responsible only for the results of his work. Well, the workers' compensation judge was a political appointee from the governor, and the governor was not about to undo the Florida Supreme Court's earlier ruling in favor of the Miami Herald and go to war with the state's major newspapers. Mrs. Sims signed the agreement and bound her son by doing so. Contracts must have a meaning. This one was not clearly against public policy, but in fact served a public need to assure that a free press was able to reach the community at a fair price. Claim dismissed. The claimant was not an employee. Druber's appeal to the Florida Supreme Court was not well received. The Miami Herald Newsboys case of 1956 governed. There was no need to overturn good law. The Miami Daily News was started back in 1896 as the Miami Metropolis. It became the Miami Daily News, the local evening paper, in 1925. Later, it occupied a famous building on Biscayne Boulevard, which is now known as the Freedom Tower, and it was the processing center for the Cuban refugees escaping Castro. Then the News built its own new building on the Miami River, but it faltered economically, and in around 1973, it moved in with the morning newspaper, the Miami Herald. The Miami News died on December 31st, 1988. The law must be stable and yet cannot stand still. That was the gold-lettered maxim cut into the paneled wall in the Cornell Moot courtroom at the Cornell Law School. It's still there. I always wondered what it really meant. The law must be stable and yet cannot stand still. Evidently, it means that there comes a time when the law gets outmoded and has to be changed, whether it's changed by a new statute or by a more reasoned judicial decision. In case you haven't noticed, there are no more newsboys selling papers on the streets. It took quite a while, but the law must have finally moved on. Charlie Sims is still limping around. You like that one?
No, I don't like it, but I mean, yeah.
Well, it really gets into some interesting things, one of which is this very questionable doctrine culcated by a group of extremists at the Yale Law School that wind up on the Supreme Court of the United States. And they have this almost a cult where they believe that the Constitution is interpreted as of the day it's written. So you don't provide for automobiles or electricity or airplanes or anything like that. And you have to go back to the mentality of the people that
originally drafted it.
Yeah, well, they didn't know about the newsboys selling newspapers on the streets. And they didn't know about child labor. When the courts rule in these cases about the rights of minors and protect minors, they say that newspapers are in the course of commerce. Under the commerce provision of the United States Constitution, the newsboys are covered by federal law. They're accused of legislating from the bench. Well, if you look at the history of child labor, you can see what happened. The courts say, wait a minute, we're not legislating from the bench, we're applying common law. And that's how the world changed. That's how case law, English law, changed and became the right of judicial review. And Marlboro versus Madison, they can, by a dicta in a single case, the Supreme Court obtained jurisdiction to determine the constitutionality or unconstitutionality of laws. So that was not in the Constitution. That was dicta. So there was an example of the court stretching its jurisdiction and power, legislating from the bench, they say, but it's not. It's interpreting the Constitution in a way that is protective of society. And in this instance, a child labor becomes a very interesting discussion. In fact, if you go back, you'll see that until 1938, the Supreme Court had really turned its back on any child labor laws and declared them unconstitutional. There had been a number of them. And finally, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was sustained as constitutional by the United States. I don't mean to give you legal jargon and talk, but it's a big problem, clearly.
Well, yeah, because what you said you don't see them out on the street anymore, yet in this case they didn't prevail, but, you know, what happened?
What happened? Well, that was the Cornell Moot Court statement that was on the walls of the Moot Courtroom. It said the law must be stable and yet cannot stand still. In other words, if it's a bad thing, you can only take it so long and then you got to change it. And the decisions that sustain things have to be looked at again. Well, now you have the opposite going on, where you have a member of the United States Supreme Court saying the good decisions that we have to be re-looked at again and go back to the bad decisions.
Back to the old
rules.
Roe versus Wade.
That's a good example of it, sure. Yeah. Well, that's not in particular. There's a number of them.
Yeah.
And one of the justices now has come up with this idea that we've got to go backwards. Of course, a lot of people with flags flying and drums beating want to march backwards to the Dark Ages, but that's what they want to do. Back to the Inquisition. So that happens. But with children, I can give you a little bit of the history of child labor. There's still a great exception. It used to be that children worked in the family, mostly in farms. That's where it started, child labor. And then in factories. In the farms, they did a lot of picking. In the fields. They were small. They could get in and out of the bushes and the plants and climb up the trees or whatever. And their education was being neglected. So they had conflicts with the requirements for a compulsory education. So there had to be a balance. And to this day, children are allowed to do more farm work than any other type. But there have to be limits. When it interferes with a child's education and they're coming out illiterate, where they're not able to make a living outside of the farm, where they get into operating equipment, particularly on a farm, threshing machines where they lose arms, operating tractors. You see 10-year-old kids operating a tractor. There's got to be some limitation. Using toxic sprays to spray trees and to spray plants, you've got to have limitations. So there are rules and regulations, safety rules in particular. Then there are requirements for school because they've got to have compulsory education. So it depends on the state. Some require compulsory education until they're 12 years old. The others require through 8th grade. Others require till you're 16. That's about where most of it stops on compulsory. Then they have limitations on what you can do and can't do when you're under a certain age. If you're 14 or under 14, on non-agricultural jobs, there's a lot of restrictions. Hours that you can work.
I was going to say, isn't there hazardous time limits?
Hazardous occupations. Then they have restrictions on 16 years and under. Then they have where the hours are restricted, and again, hazardous occupation. But once you reach 16 to 18, you're not limited in the hours, but you are limited in hazardous occupation. So they used to have these kids running in the textile mills. They would come in to repair the machines. If there was a jam in the machine, they teach them how to clear the jam, and these kids would go into the looms, and they could worm their way in. Wow. where you couldn't. They couldn't do it with robotics either. It had to be done by hand. They trained the kids how to do it. So there was a lot of injuries. Then there are things like the family business. If the family has a coffee and tea shop or a hardware store, the kid comes to work in the store. They have that now in a delicatessen at Moe's, and the 15-year-old is working behind the cash register. And everyone says, oh, how nice, that's great. Well, it is. And that's part of being involved in the family business.
So what you're saying is it's a good morally character building, but we need to be responsible about it, not take advantage of it.
Right, it's exploitative. So you have to balance it off. And it has to be safe. And that's very important, the safety. And also newspaper delivery is an area where the kids go out and have a bicycle route, you know, and they throw the paper on.
Sure, I had one.
It's good. But you got to be careful. And in certain areas, it's dangerous because there's heavy traffic and the kids ride the bicycles and the bicyclists get injured or killed. Then the other thing is in acting. There are a lot of child actors. Nobody thinks about it. They dance and they sing and they're on quiz shows and they're in the family sitcoms and they're in musicals. And these kids have to be protected. So they have a union now. And the Actors Guild or something where the kids have to belong if they want to work on Broadway or on television. And they have rules and regulations.
And I guess like every law, it's all a result of the abuse, not common sense, but just because somebody went too far the other way. And so they said we had to make a law. I don't know. That's my feeling, that a majority of the laws seem to be the result of abuses as opposed to saying, well, let's think about how we can protect Americans.
Well,
you know?
One of the biggest thing was the big fire in the Lower East Side of New York where all the women died of asphyxiation because the doors were locked. A dress manufacturing loft, and maybe like 500 women died or something. It was a famous case, and that caused unions to be created. So they had these safety rules and regulations about ventilation and about machinery. And even today, it's a big problem with machinery in particular. The penalties are very minimal compared to the damage that the lack of safety features on equipment can cause, particularly guards and machines to keep your hands from being torn apart. The MBAs come in and figure out that it's cheaper to pay the claims than it is. You can make more money by taking off the guards and paying the claims. And they don't think in terms of humans, they think in terms of money. And that's a culture that has been created and maintained by a business primarily and exclusively interested in making money.
So now, would you go so far as to, without, you know, getting too political or anything, but would you say that that's a trait of capitalism, or that it's prevalent even in a socialist society?
There's nothing to do with capitalism or socialism or your religion
it's
or
money.
Your size or the color of your skin. It has to do with money and greed, and that has to do with an indifference to the human condition. And every society has a concern for the human condition, everyone, just a question of how you approach it. My thought is that you don't want to lose track of your values by virtue of balancing money against human suffering or damage. So if you have to, for example, if you have to call cars back for a repair of something, an airbag, and you figure out the cost of bringing the cars back and replacing the airbags as opposed to the number of claims that are going to result from injuries due to the airbag not functioning, it's cheaper to leave the airbags in the car and pay the claims. But that's not the answer. And the directors of the corporations have to understand that they have a duty to the public